Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Hospital Performance Improvement Public Reporting Pneumonia Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would like to now introduce our host for today's conference, Mr. Gardner, Project Manager of iPro. Mr. Gardner, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Dante, and welcome to the Public Performance Conference Call on Pneumonia. The materials that were posted on Jenny, you should have received an agenda. There are a list of validation questions that we'll talk about today. There's a sample standing orders policy, as well as a sample standing orders order form, and there's a meeting evaluation form. We'll remind you again at the end of the call, but we do appreciate those meeting evaluation forms being filled out, as it does give us good insight and direction as to present and future conference calls. Joining me today from iPro are Karen O'Leary, who is responsible for the public reporting end of and all of that work that goes on. Dr. Charles Stimmler is the medical director for iPro. Denise Faulkner-Cameron is a project manager, and she primarily oversees the SCIP program. And myself, I'm Bill Gardner, and I'm a project manager, and I oversee the appropriate care measures. For today's call, we are going to talk about pneumonia and basically the public reported measures for pneumonia. There are three required measures, if you will, the core measures for pneumonia, the oxygen assessment within 24 hours prior to or after arrival to the hospital, the pneumococcal vaccination. Patients age 65 and older are screened for and administered the vaccination prior to discharge, if appropriate, and the initial antibiotic being received within 4 hours of hospital arrival. The expanded measures for the pneumonia measure set are basically the blood culture performed in the emergency department prior to initial antibiotic received in the hospital, the adult smoking cessation advice and counseling for those who have smoked cigarettes any time during the year prior to the hospital arrival, and finally, the initial antibiotic selection for community-acquired pneumonia in immunocompetent patients. For today's call, we had asked for and received a number of questions that deal with data abstraction and validation. And these are an ongoing, continuously evolving sets of data that CMS has asked for and we collect data for. So as we have asked for questions, we did receive a number of these, and what you have in front of you should be a total of 14 questions. And what we'll do is we'll do the question and answer session with Karen and myself. And right now you only have the questions in front of you. And after the call, following the call, we will post the questions and the answers to Jenny. So you'll have that information. So if you don't feel like you need to write hurriedly for the answers and everything, you'll have the exact answers that we're giving here today. So as an initial introduction here, again, I want to introduce Karen O'Leary, and she will help with the data abstraction questions and answers.
Okay. Go ahead, Bill.
All right. The first question, if a patient is admitted to another hospital, stayed 3 days, and then was transferred to our hospital, how do we answer the following question? Is there documentation that the patient had a risk for health care-associated pneumonia?
And for this question, you would answer yes. Since this would qualify under the allowable value, value number one, hospitalization for 2 days within the last 90 days, if there is documentation of a 3-day stay in the current record.
The second question. A patient receives wound care every other day in the ED because he is homeless. Would this be considered documented risk for healthcare-associated pneumonia?
The answer is yes. To the data element healthcare-associated pneumonia under the allowable value number 4, home wound care within 30 days. And for this question in particular, this patient is homeless. However, they do fall under the home wound care because they're coming in every other day for this wound care.
So that serves as an appropriate site for administration of the care?
Yes.
Okay. Question number 3. A patient is admitted for exacerbation of COPD and rule out pneumonia. The patient was not on any immunosuppressive therapies prior to arrival. During the hospital stay, the patient receives prednisone. The question is there documentation the patient had a compromising condition?
Okay. Under the allowable values, systemic immunosuppressive therapy is listed. However, a patient will not become immediately immunocompromised when placed on a steroid like prednisone. So the answer to this data element compromised, asking if there is documentation the patient had a compromising condition, this would be answered as a no. Remember, a single dose does not constitute therapy. And if there is no time frame documented, answer no to this question.
Okay, question number 4, relating to comfort measures only. Our hospital uses a full-page DNR order form signed by the physician. Elements on the form include a treatment plan and the words comfort and supportive care only. If this box is checked off and there is no other documentation of comfort care only in the chart, does this qualify as a yes answer for comfort measures only, even though it is part of our DNR order?
And since comfort and supportive care only is listed as a treatment plan and the form is signed by the physician, it can be abstracted as a yes. Remember, both comfort care measures only and supportive care only are inclusions. This comes up a lot, so important to know.
Okay. Question number 5. A patient arrives in the ER and is admitted. However, the ER physician did not order blood cultures. Subsequently, the resident writes admission orders while the patient is awaiting a bed. The resident's ordered, written after admission, include blood cultures and they are drawn in the ER. Would we answer yes to the initial blood culture collected in the ED data element, even though the ER physician did not order?
Since the admission orders were already written, and the patient was just waiting on bed placement, this would be answered no. This measure only includes blood cultures performed while the patient is an ER patient. It's very important to note. This element currently is reflective of the patient's status, not the physical location. So basically, once the admission has been made, regardless of where the patient is, whether they're on the floor or in the ED, he or she is now an inpatient. Clarifications will be being made to this probably not for quite some time in the second next release of the version manual.
Okay. Question number 6. If an antibiotic is written as a generic name, then written again in the brand name and given at a different time but the same route, do we have to put the name of each antibiotic or just the route if it has changed? The data dictionary states for pneumonia, document the name of each antibiotic administered during the first 36 hours.
You only have to capture each antibiotic once unless there is a change in route. So see Appendix C, the medication table. Prior to 1106 discharges, there was no antibiotic table crosswalk, and both antibiotics would have had to be captured. Now, with the crosswalk, which is basically the alignment between JACO and CMS, you only have to capture each antibiotic once, regardless of the generic or brand name.
We're going to move into some questions now related to pneumonia and the working diagnosis on admission. And this is probably one of the more frequent areas that we get questions asked about. The first question is actually question number 7. And the question is, COPD with recent pneumonia was listed on an H&P as one of the admitting diagnoses. Does this qualify as an acceptable working diagnosis of pneumonia?
And the answer is no. As recent could mean a month ago or 2 days ago, as it means different things to different people. It needs to be more specific. If the documentation says something like resolving pneumonia, then this would indicate the patient currently has pneumonia, and then you would be able to say yes to working diagnosis.
Okay, the next question is question number 8. We have a patient who was seen in the ED. On the ED department record, the physician lists pneumonia as one of the 6 differential diagnoses. Would this be a yes or no to working diagnosis of pneumonia?
This would be a yes. Differential diagnoses are acceptable since the physician may be considering a number of diagnoses at the time. Currently, physician, nurse practitioner, or PA's documentation of pneumonia on a differential diagnosis is appropriate to answer yes. And keep in mind, unless there is a final discharge code on pneumonia, the chart will not be included in the pneumonia population.
Question number 9. We have a patient with an admitting diagnosis code of 518.81 respiratory failure and a secondary diagnosis of pneumonia the day after admission. Does this meet the requirements for pneumonia diagnosis on admission?
Okay. If there was a different diagnosis upon admission and pneumonia was not determined until the day after admission, unless the direct admit, then the answer is no. However, as long as pneumonia, even if a secondary, is documented and it can be abstracted for working diagnosis of pneumonia, and this documentation must be from an abstractable source at or prior to admission. Remember, diagnosis codes are not abstractable for working diagnosis. I know that there may be some confusion with that reflecting to the last question we just answered, but we can take questions at the end to give some more clarification.
Question number 10. If a patient comes in through the ER and the ER physician diagnoses rule out sepsis and then he proceeds to order the pneumonia protocol order set for that patient on admission, would this be considered falling into a working diagnosis for pneumonia?
Yes. Pneumonia can be abstracted from orders and or protocols. Pneumonia does not need to be the only or primary diagnosis to establish a working diagnosis.
So just clarify for me on that. So we don't necessarily have a diagnosis of pneumonia, but we've got an order set that's reflective of a diagnosis of pneumonia.
Correct. And obviously the physician is considering pneumonia. Hence, he's ordering the protocol for such.
Okay.
Okay, so he's putting the wheels in motion to treat it as such.
Okay. Question number 11. The ER nursing documentation includes pneumonia as a diagnosis, but the word pneumonia does not appear anywhere else in the ERMD diagnosis. Question, would RN documentation of pneumonia qualify as a working diagnosis?
And the answer is no. Documentation of a diagnosis must be made by an MD, PA, or a nurse practitioner.
Okay. Question number 12. A patient is admitted through the ED. On the admitting orders, the physician writes, diagnosis seizure, heroin intoxication, rule out pneumonia aspiration. Would this be a working diagnosis of pneumonia?
This would not be a working diagnosis, as aspiration pneumonia is an exclusion.
And that
happens a lot.
Yeah, okay. That's stated right up front, though,
right.
In the diagnosis of pneumonia.
Right. And also he was questioning it, rule out pneumonia aspiration question mark. So, you know, go a little further with that.
Okay. Question number 13. The physician documents twice in our ED record. The physician documents in the first place, consider diagnoses based upon the patient's presentation, and he/she also documents based on the clinical impression. Many charts we abstract have a clinical impression of sepsis, but the diagnosis listed states pneumonia, which we count as a working diagnosis. Is this correct?
And yes, this is correct. Currently, if pneumonia is suspected at any time from arrival to the ED through the time of admission, it will be a yes to working diagnosis. And according to this example here, there was documentation of the diagnosis being listed as pneumonia.
Okay, and the last question that we have is question number 14. A recent review of the QNET specs manual under the section Pneumonia Measure Population revealed that in order to be included in the pneumonia population, a patient must have a working diagnosis of pneumonia before or at admission and must have a chest x-ray or CT scan that indicates pneumonia within 24 hours prior to arrival or any time during the hospitalization. Do I understand that a chest x-ray indicating pneumonia is now necessary to include the patient in the measure as opposed to just a diagnosis?
And the answer is yes. Beginning with July 1st, 2006 discharges, patients will have to have a positive chest x-ray or CT scan and a working diagnosis of pneumonia in order to be in the population. This is sort of their remedy short-term of the issues everybody has been having with documentation and abstraction for working diagnosis on admission. The July 1st, 2006 is version 2.0 of the SPECS manual. And I'll turn it back to you, Bill.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. Again, we will ask. We will have a question and answer session at the end of the call. So, at this point, we're going to move into a discussion of some QI strategies, and basically, we're going to talk about the implementation of standing orders for immunization. The New York State Education Department authorizes non-patient-specific standing orders and protocol guidelines. And basically, these are authorized for certain immunizations, anti-anaphylactic agents, and PPD Mantoux skin tests. So with this, we wanted to have a discussion and talk about, with one facility who has actually implemented standing orders and learn from their experience with the implementation of the standing order protocol. On today's call are presenters from Benedictine Hospital in Kingston, New York. We have Sister Gabrielle Keenan, who is Vice President for Quality Resource Management. We have Mr. Coy Smith, who is the Vice President for Patient Care Services. We have Ms. Mary Ellen Crittenden. She is the Director of Quality Resource Management. And we have Ms. Lorna DeGrazia, who is an infection control coordinator. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
thank you for joining us on today's call. And we have a list of questions here that we just kind of want to go over and glean from your experience about some of the difficulties that you had, or maybe you didn't have any, which would be delightful to hear, but also in how you implemented standing orders within your facility itself. The first thing I'd like to ask, and again, initially when you respond to a question, if you would just identify yourself so that we do know who's answering the question, because we do have four people on the call here. For your hospital, why did you decide to move to a standing orders protocol?
This is Coy Smith. I'm the Vice President for Patient Care, and maybe it will help if I just sort of have different people on the team address this. But the main reason, I think it was, is that we were very excited that the Department of Health led the charge here and allowed these to be sort of nurse-directed order sets. And it was, you know, it's a fairly new thing for most areas of care in New York State. We saw it as the right thing to do, and we thanks to a fairly progressive infection control committee, a medical director, and Lorna, our infection control nurse, we met with great support. One of our nurse directors at the time sort of learned about the regulation change and, you know, brought it to infection control, and Dr. Tack is an expert in this area and decided to help us with what the order should read and use the prototypes from the state. And so it was really more of a, you know, a professional model kind of thing at first, being the right thing to do, and that we believe that this would be a great project for all of the practicing RNs to get involved with. That, I guess that's why we started initially, and that was 3 years ago.
This is Sister Gabrielle, and I might add to that I think we saw that as a breakthrough for us. Without that, we wouldn't have had the support to go where we were going. And as Coy said, Dr. Tack and Lorna both supported this very much, so it went through the Infection Control Committee. And from there, Lorna, you may want to add to that.
Yes, and we had a pre-existing team because we had a high-risk population with resistant organisms, so we had a team approach to monitor and screen those patients and had a lot of buy-in from all of the units with leadership from QA, nursing, infection control, and out on the unit. So we had that team in place where they were sharp, they were screening, and they said, let's go forward and try to intervene and prevent community-acquired pneumonia. And so we did a screening tool to check out the status of the patients coming in. Did they have influenza vaccine? Did they have pneumococcal and other high-risk factors? What were their additional diagnoses that put them at higher risk in order to meet their needs with appropriate antibiotics, screening for O2 assessment, the blood culture timing, and appropriateness of correct antibiotics related to the specific pneumonia.
Yeah, we had started the screening before the nurse-driven order set, and we would find out that a patient was eligible for a vaccination, but an immunization, but we couldn't always obtain the physician orders in a timely fashion. The patient would be discharged before we actually had a chance to get an order and get it administered. So that was a stumbling block. So when this change happened at the state level, it really then facilitated us moving to the next step because we were kind of frustrated with it.
So with the implementation of this and with your initial group, it sounds like you had the ID doc on board. You had the director of nursing. Coy, did you sit on that group also?
I was involved with it along the way. I'm not in infection control, but I'm involved in the patient care services council level and the quality improvement levels. I'm on the board quality committee, so that's a good thing. And Dr. Tack, you have to have a physician champion to really, you have to have a nurse champion, a physician champion, and you have to have good support from QA and from infection control. So it is a team approach. If you don't have all four of those players, supporting the project, it is harder to get it done. I think in today's environment with pay-for-performance, I think everybody's kind of getting on the bandwagon now. But you have to have it. It's a team approach, and Dr. Tack has always been either on the board or the medical QA, medical executive committee. So because he's at high levels in the organization and he's very articulate, he didn't take much convincing to have the nurse-driven protocols go forward. It was a little scary thing at first for everybody to suddenly say this is going to happen. The oncologists were leery at first with some of their immunocompromised patients, and they really wanted to be brought in earlier in the process rather than having it just be automatic. But I think as time went on, we earned their trust, too, and we learned to appropriately screen. We have a pretty senior oncology nursing staff up there, so they're moving forward with it.
Well, quite frankly, I think also the nurses were reticent at first.
Oh, yeah. We had problems.
It took quite a bit of education and education and education to give them that support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Part of what we found was that they, this was kind of a new area, and, it would be some handoff. There was handoff issues because we get the drug on the floor, and then another shift would come on, and then it would get forgotten in the refrigerator. But beyond that, I think there was just some fear, some anxiety. I know Ann Cardinale, a clinical nurse specialist, just walked in the room, and she was very active in telling the nursing staff that if you're nervous about doing this the first couple of times, I'll come with you and actually do it with you, so we can screen and administer it together. That helped. We also implemented an admission nurse who part of her admission process is to do all of the screenings and the immunizations, and that really helped because during the daytime hours, she would get at least a critical mass going and would do a real good job communicating with the next shift to get the job done. But we had our fits and starts. If you look at our trend line over from April of 2004 to March of 2006, you'll see a steady trend line up, but it trended in the 50s to now above 80 overall, and we've had months at 100% now.
Very good. basically, did you establish long-term and short-term goals with the implementation of this, or did you just kind of figure that you were going to do it all across the board, or how did you approach that?
Well, I'll let Mary Ellen talk about that, because we've had some of these various collaborative groups and appropriate care measure groups going over the years, and we've tried to establish goals for each of them.
Hi, this is Mary Ellen Crittenden. We were part of the IPRO collaborative working on pneumonia. So with that, we tend as an organization to jump right in. I know that there are recommendations to pilot test things on certain units. We're a small community hospital, 222 beds. We've got three primary units where we're doing the screening. So right off the start, we implemented it housewide. Dr. Tack, our infection control coordinator, Lorna, we set goals of 100%. It took a while to get there, but, we eventually did.
And how did you address the use of standing orders for inpatient admission? Did you only do inpatient admissions, or did you address ER visits at all and include them?
It's only inpatient, really, right now. But we are expanding it in terms of pre-surgical visits. We have a pre-surgical visit program that's very active, and so the screening occurs there. And for patients that are going to be admitted, they are slated to get the immunization on arrival. But no, we really haven't addressed it for the treat and release population at this point.
Okay. So this, the same-day admission population is, I don't know how many outpatient surgeries you do, but or how many screenings you do, and then the patient comes to you as an inpatient, but that's probably an important population to catch.
Yeah, it is. It's a good percentage of our surgical population, and if you don't catch it there, it's more apt to get missed.
Now, okay. Director Sharon Crasher has been addressing that. So we're moving along on that.
Yeah, okay. You talked about the formation of your team and the people who were on there. You said that you identified the patient population as inpatient. And did you have to create new forms or protocols or worksheets or policies or procedures? How did that all come about?
Well, absolutely. We went through our Nursing Practice Council and our Management Council, and we did create a new policy, and we did create standing orders that had to be approved by the Medical Executive Committee, and so those were all done. And the form has been revised a couple of times, but this is like an original one. This is 03, I see it. Did we revise it at all?
On the bottom.
Yeah.
503.
Yeah, 03. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we did have to create a policy and a form.
And that also went through, first of all, I think, Infection Control Committee.
Yeah.
And Dr. Tack, again, was championing that movement, I think.
And when we had the standing orders in place, but people were still being noncompliant, Dr. Tack came right to our Patient Care Services Council and kind of reprimanded the nurses. He said, we've empowered you to give the vaccine. We've gone through medical QA, pharmacy and therapeutics committee. You have this power. Now let's utilize it. You're educated people. You can do this. And so there was still a little anxiety on the nurse's account, but this kind of pushed them forward, whether it was out of we demand of this of you or just a little anxiety. But then that's when Ann Cardinale got on the units and assisted in this also.
This was about a year ago. This is Mary Ellen. This was about a year ago that we found that our rates were not anywhere near where we wanted them to be. In our chart abstraction, we found the forms were either not in the chart or sometimes in the chart and not complete. So we brought this back to Dr. Tack, Infection Control Committee, to the Board QA Committee, and then it was communicated back to the Patient Care Services Council. We then started to track screening compliance by nursing units. We provided feedback to each nursing unit on a monthly basis, and with that and with Dr. Tack's directive, I think we then really became, and Ann Cardinale working with the nurses, we really came back then.
When you initially started this process, did you meet monthly or more often than that? How long did it take you to really kind of get the nuts and bolts together so that you could start to implement?
Generally, we met monthly. We would do our retrospective chart review, let's say, you know, for March, and then we would meet in April, review our findings. It also coincided with the senior leader reports that we did with the IPRO Collaborative, so that worked well.
Okay. And you said that you did data collection and you fed the information back to the units themselves. Did you have pharmacy involved in this part of the process at all?
Yeah, pharmacy was always integral in the process. In fact, our director of pharmacy came up with some great little strategies that helped with compliance as well, like pre-printing on the medication administration record for all patients over 65, the pneumonia and influenza vaccines, so that the nurse had to actively, you know, circle it as not given if it wasn't indicated, or say it wasn't indicated. So that was another physical reminder to say, oh, I better go look to see if the medication is in the refrigerator, go look at the screening form, which should be in the same place in the chart for every patient, and then give it. So that was another physical reminder. We're a fairly manual system, but we do have a pharmacy system that can add notes and things like that to our MARs.
Uh-huh.
We also added the immunization screening to our discharge form so that it was just another check place to, you know, for the nurse to verify that if, in fact, you know, they were should have gotten the vaccine, that they actually got it. So the last check, basically.
Right.
Lorna, in addition, for long-term care, Ann Cardinale is involved with like the Benicare and elderly, what's the term?
Well, actually, this is Ann Cardinale. I'm a clinical nurse specialist in geriatrics, but we do a collaborative with the area nursing homes and assisted living facilities, and what we did is we brought the information to them of the need for the immunization and best practice for pneumococcal and influenza, and they were right on board with us. In fact, they had either adapted our little sticker for where and when did they, at the last time they were immunized, for their transfer sheets, or they created their own immunization records, and it was really working well because one of the the roadblocks that I was noticing in doing chart review was that the nurse, in indicating whether they had been immunized previously, could not find any record for long-term care patients who were admitted to our hospital, but now they know exactly where to look for it, and we're seeing more compliance with that, so that was really a big step. And I also want to mention that in the educational phase for our nurses, many in our little checkbox, they would check off unable to assess the patient due to mental status. At that point in time, patient may have been too sick to even talk about whether they had an immunization, let alone, you know, how they were feeling. But we needed to educate the nurse. Once that box was checked, then they would have to go back in a day or two to say, you know, give some education to the patient. And even if the patient refused, if someone went in the next day with a brochure, how important it is for pneumococcal vaccine, I give them a little statistics and areas that they could understand, most assuredly they would say, you know, Ron, I think I might get this vaccine. So that's been working too.
How many facilities did you work with, like long-term care facilities, that you might receive patients from? Do you have a...
Well, actually, the areas within our 50-mile radius is the 50-mile radius of Benedictine Hospital. They're all invited to our collaborative, but we generally get about, I'd say about 6 to 10.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a matter of concentrating on those facilities and
yes, right, within our area.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think because of these initiatives, the overall rate of immunization has gone up over the years, and you know, the nurses just couldn't take the time to make a phone call to the skilled facility to find out whether or not the patient was vaccinated. So they, you know, and there was also a time when they didn't know whether if they had double vaccinations, would that be a bad thing? And so, you know, that was a drawback. But once they could clearly see it on the admission whether they had have it, that was good because we could mark it down.
Yeah,
so it was great.
You know, that ties into primarily the next area that I wanted to talk about, and that is training. You certainly touched on training of outside facilities, but how did you train your staff in-house? You know, when you've got a facility like yours, I mean, you're talking three shifts. You're talking a litany of people who need to be trained and educated in something like this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I would say that, you know, that's probably one area that we could have probably put more energy on in the early days. However, we have an active education council and a management council, so the information was disseminated through that and also the practice and QI council. So it was disseminated to at least a core of leadership and of senior staff. And, you know, every manager was required to bring it back to staff meetings. We did have some champions going around and providing hands-on education unit to unit and shift by shift, but the night shift is the one that, you know, would take some time getting them into staff meetings and into training. So that, I would say, that's a recommendation for anybody, and it's pretty obvious, I guess, for those that do staff development, but to really make sure you have a solid off-shift and weekend strategy so that those folks get the education and the materials early on. I mean, they're supposed to be self-directed and read the, you know, staff meeting minutes and look at the materials, but, nurses are really do better with hands-on education with people that can express a level of confidence about what's going on.
Yeah.
And it also comes with nag, and the variant letters.
We now send each month when we do this, we got abstraction, we send out a variant letter. So if a immunization form is either not in the chart, although most of the time it is, but let's say it is blank, it's not completed, or the patient could have had the vaccine and it wasn't followed through on, then we send a variant letter to not only the nurse manager, the nurse that discharged the patient, that admitted the patient, as well as the physician. So getting constant feedback to the staff and awareness.
That's great that you have that one-on-one feedback to people.
And it's meant in an educational standpoint. It's not punitive. It's so that they can learn.
One of our newer strategies is to, you know, we've always been very unit-based, but we want to emphasize that. We have a clinical ladder for our registered nurses, and as they progress up, they need to have clinical and process projects on the units. And so we try to get champions on every unit for the various patient satisfaction issues or for any of these quality improvement issues. And, you know, gradually we're getting people on the units that are becoming champions also for this area. But it's, you know, it's a slow process, and there's a million projects.
Yeah. Do you have any kind of visual displays throughout the hospital around the specific floors as far as your improvements? Specific to how successful you have been with your projects themselves?
We do provide graphs monthly to each nursing unit. They post them in their conference room or where they eat. They're pretty much throughout the organization.
Oh, that's great.
And Lorna has had a poster presentation for the road that she's presented at a number of both our internal meetings. It was posted when Joint Commission was here. We've had it out and about on and off over the years. So, we do that as well.
We presented it originally to Dr. Stimler at one of the initial conference calls down in Manhattan. So that's where it started, and we just keep updating the graphs and taking it as a roadshow internally.
Yes, okay. I guess I've got a couple more questions here. Is that primarily, what was the one tool you found most effective in making improvements in your measurements?
I think that one of the things was the feedback to the unit, showing the unit comparison of the different screening rates and the individual feedback as well.
I mean, clearly you have to have the pre-printed tool, and that has to be very familiar to everybody and have a very common place. So just adoption of the tool and providing education for it, and that and having champions, having senior staff be champions, and sort of blazing the trail for the younger staff.
I think also having the admission nurse has been definitely a benefit, not only for, you know, the pneumonia measures, but our other initiatives that we're working on. She really does a great job in screening for the different initiatives.
Yeah, and I think, too, having Dr. Tack reassure the nurses, if in doubt on the pneumococcal vaccine, give the vaccine, and then you have that baseline, you have the date.
Yeah.
And within our record. So I think that really, you know, encouraged the nurses, and he's very vocal on the unit if he sees that perhaps one of the vaccines was not given, and the answer or feedback is, well, gee, I don't know if he had it. I tried to find out. Well, Dr. Tack will tell you, if in doubt, you want to give it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we recently had a conversation at the Quality Improvement Council last week where a nurse on the floor said, you know, I'm just floating here, but I noticed that the screening tool wasn't with the admission packet. And what happened was we found a breakdown in the system. The new unit clerk didn't know that they were supposed to prepare the packets that way and in advance for the off shift, so that very quickly the assistant manager there worked with the new clerk, and now we have ample admission packets with all the appropriate forms in them. So it's amazing how we do require, you know, cues.
That's amazing you said that, Coy, because it just happened this morning that a night nurse, we were talking about the pneumococcal screening, and she said, oh, I'm so glad now the new packet had that in there, and that just happened today, and she was able to assess for the immunization. So good job done.
Yeah, that is good. And one of the last things is, what's the biggest barrier you had to overcome in the process?
Lack of knowledge and fear. Yeah.
Fear.
There
was a lot of anxiety in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The nurse is reluctant to administer, even though we have the standing order, the vaccine. And if they were in doubt, you know, should they do it, should they not, will the patient die from a second shot, you know, so the education piece.
And then communication from shift to shift. I think that we lost a lot between shifts because the patient would come in near the end of one shift and then it would go into the off shifts, and then the next day would be a whole new crew of people. So, you know, continuity of care and communication, having, you know, we actually have gone back to having a cardiac system here, and on there is a very clear-cut section that's all about appropriate care measures, and that stays with the patient for their whole admission. So, you know, every day, every shift, you can see what was done and what wasn't done for the patient.
That information is constantly in front of people.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's great. You know, one of the things that we're interested here at iPro in being a participant in the collaborative is really sharing of tools. And, you know, you've referred to your order sheet that you have, and I was wondering if you would be willing to share that and with the participants so that even though we included a sample in today's presentation, again, that's one sample, one example, and perhaps you might have something that you've designed for yourself that might work better for others.
Yes, we'll email that to you. We have a risk assessment with a check-off, and then contraindications column on the left for influenza with contraindications for pneumococcal on the right. Then the next section's on the vaccine assessment and education for both, and then if the vaccine was not given, why, whether it's refusal, risk for not at risk for disease, the vaccine won't work, fear of side effects. They may want further advice from the physician or family, or rather receive it elsewhere, and then other documentation, and, of course, if we're unable to assess. So at the bottom, under Section 2, we actually have the dosing, site, manufacturer, lot number, expiration date, and then the nurse can sign off on that, and that's the record.
Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you very much. And I will post that to Jenny, and I'll let people know on the call once that's done. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And with all of you at Benedictine, thank you very much for your presentation and your willingness to discuss this. I think it's very helpful. As with any implementation, the process is not as smooth as you think it's going to be or would like it to be. But I appreciate your candor in sharing some of your difficulties and actually sharing your successes with the implementation of this.
Sister Gabrielle, thank you for your comments. And I just want to say you can see there's lots of reasons to be proud for the team effort here that has been put forth. And I, for one, can say they work like well-oiled machines.
That's great.
Hey, Bill?
Yes.
Oh, good. I can be. I didn't know if the phone was working where I am. This is Dr. Stimler. I know you're going to open up for questions and answers in just a moment. I was wondering if I could ask one or two questions of my own, a bit more clinical and physician-related.
Absolutely.
I was just curious, just because it may have been mentioned in the presentation, but I might have missed it. What is the earliest time during hospitalization that you've given patients a pneumococcal vaccine? And, you know, is there a stability? I mean, is there any kind of criteria as far as, you know, whether you need to wait past a certain critical period before you give the vaccine? Or how is that handled?
We provide the immunization on admission. If they are admitted to ICU, then what we do is we screen and then actually provide the administer the vaccine when they are transferred to, like, the med-surg unit when they're more stable. I believe that's consistent with the CDC guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. You folks can still hear me, right?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Great. I want to point out, and it's very important, and it also relates to something you had said about the oncologists being leery. Someone had made a comment earlier that was one of the groups that had expressed some initial reservations about, you know, giving these vaccinations. These are both inactivated. I mean, these are, you know, either protein derivatives or they're killed vaccines. It's not possible to get the disease from the vaccine. So the reason that you would wait for a period of stability is not because you're worried about an adverse event on the part of the patient, but it's because the immune response to the vaccine or the ability for the vaccine to provide protection against the disease is going to perhaps be more optimal when the patient has a more intact immune system. But, you know, there's often the misconception that you're waiting when the patient's unstable because you're worried that this is going to be harmful in some way. But the reality is it's not the case. You're waiting because you want to optimize the immune response. If you look at the risk assessment sheet that Benedictine has provided, you'll see that among the high-risk conditions that are indications for both pneumococcal and influenza vaccine include severe immunocompromise, not just the leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma. And by the way, these are hematologic malignancies. My background happens to be in hemonc. You know, these are the hematologic malignancies that are particularly associated with immune suppression. You also see HIV infection or AIDS, and then you also see organ and bone marrow transplant, you know, with radiation therapy and corticosteroids. I mean, you can't knock an immune system further down than this. So there isn't a risk of patients contracting a disease from the immunization. Clearly, these are people who are the most immunocompromised. What you're trying to do is you want to give these patients the vaccine because they are so immune compromised. You want to try to prevent them from getting the pneumococcal and influenza diseases. And that might be why the oncologists were concerned that the vaccine should be given at a time when they're relatively immunocompetent so they can mount some kind of a antibody and cellular immune response to the vaccine. But I hope it wasn't the oncologist's concern that there would be any kind of a, you know, adverse event from the vaccine. But they should be concerned that it should be given at a time when the patient would benefit the most from it. But clearly, oncology patients are among the most urgent who need this vaccine.
Right, yeah. Thank you very much for emphasizing that. Yeah, we understand that, but I think it was a little bit of both in the beginning.
But Dr. Tack, again, was our cheerleader. He intervened with the oncologist and stated essentially what you did, that you want to optimize the immune response.
Do you have any other questions, Dr. Stemler?
I guess just one other very quick one. Just out of curiosity, were there any issues? We had heard upon occasion that in hospitals, sometimes there are individual physicians that disagree with the standing orders, and they kind of give mixed messages to the nurses who are trying to follow the protocol, and then kind of get kind of a backlash from the physician that, you know, I prefer my patients don't get the vaccine. I was just wondering if any kind of, you know, communication issues have arisen in that along those lines.
There were a few initially, but we just kept at them saying that this is what's mandated. So eventually we won them over as we saw their other colleagues were more and more compliant and they had buy-in to it.
And I guess, I mean, that would seem to me to be about the best you could do. You know, peer pressure is very helpful. I think, you know, just continuing to drive home the point that every guideline out there, every national guideline on immunizations is calling for the use of standing orders. So this is not something that's kind of a cutting-edge initiative at this point. This is something that is a standard of care. So thank you.
Thank you.
At this point in time, I'd like to turn the call back to Karen O'Leary. She has some updates that she would like to go over.
Sure. And this is just a – we are switching gears a little bit here until we open up for questions and answers. For public reporting, I did want to give out just a few updates. Hospitals should be looking for their quarter four 2005 requests for charts for validation. They are being mailed out by the CDAC probably tomorrow. So you should be receiving them either Friday, Monday, or Tuesday. And again, you know you'll have 30 days to return those charts. The other update I wanted to give regarding the proposed rule for the APU, I know you have a lot of you have seen it on the At a Glance, have also read it. I do want to let people know there is no new pledge form for this new proposed ruling because it has not been finalized yet. We are waiting from CMS for this form, and when we get it, we will absolutely get it out to you guys. Lastly, if you have not contacted your vendor regarding collection of the additional measures and SIP 1 and 3 measures, please do so as well as to call me because we are very much encouraging hospitals to begin collection of SIP data and the additional measures and submission of this data. So if you have any questions, please do give me a call. We are very limited in our information at this point, but I can help you out a little bit and instruct you on what to do at this point in QualityNet Exchange. And I think that's it.
Okay. Dante, I think we would like to open up the call to questions at this point, if you would do that.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, please press the pound key. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. One moment for questions. Our first question comes from Carly Ida. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm Ida Carly from Our Lady of Mercy. My question is about the nursing home patients. Are they included in the pneumonia for community-acquired pneumonia?
This is Ann Cardinelli. I'll answer that, absolutely. We want to make sure that our long-term care residents or our residents or our patients are immunized against the pneumococcal disease, absolutely. That's why we work strongly with the nursing home long-term care facilities to establish an easy place to document where when the vaccine was administered.
In fact, Ann Cardinale, this is Lorna, Ann Cardinale started the Benedictine Hospital Long-Term Care Collaborative, and I forgot she did invite me, and we educated. We gave our screening tool and the pneumococcal influenza informational packets from the state to the long-term care facilities. As she said, there were 6 to 10 involved, so we made sure they had it so they could educate their staff, and that incorporated in their transfer admission form so that we would have that data and know that they did their screening process on their end prior to transfer.
Can I answer your question, Ida?
No, I'm asking about the pneumonia patients in general. When we're abstracting for the community acquired, why are the nursing home patients included in the denominator?
We're not connected to a nursing home, so it's every admission that comes in the door, whether they're transferred from another facility, long-term care, or directly from the community, they're all getting asked the same question. Is that what you're looking at? They're all in our denominator of admissions.
Hospital admissions.
Now, some facilities have an acute care facility, and then next door is their long-term care. Maybe they break that data down separately. We don't have that option. We're just one large facility. Does that clarify?
No, what I'll do is I'll go on to Quest and ask the question. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Ida.
Hi, this is Dr. Stimler. I think the question may have been asked about if for some nursing home patients who are in skilled nursing facilities where they may treat with antibiotics, the issue of whether they're in the denominator for some of the indicators may be an exclusion, and this is something that I don't know. I don't have the actual exclusion list sitting in front of me. I don't know. Bill, if you happen to have the specifications for healthcare-associated pneumonia handy at this moment, but for at least selection of antibiotics, I think that's a very good question because, you know, patients admitted from certain skilled nursing environments may be at you know, higher risk for resistant organisms such as Pseudomonas. There are nursing homes that have even respirator units, and those patients coming in probably are not really candidates for the usual guideline-derived antibiotic combinations because they're not the garden variety of community-acquired pneumonia, but rather they're more likely coming in with Pseudomonas or with more resistant pneumonia. So for individual indicators in the community-acquired pneumonia set, I could see where that's a very important question. For some of them, like pneumococcal vaccine or oxygenation, clearly they need to be in the denominator for those because there's no reason that you would want to take them out. Bill, do you have any more information at the moment about healthcare-associated pneumonia, whether skilled nursing facilities is an exclusion?
We don't have that right now, but we will verify that as far as the inclusion and exclusion criteria. And we will post that as a question and follow up.
Okay, because this question does come up from time to time, and a lot of it may have to do with the, you know, the level of care that's provided at the nursing home. I think it may be an exclusion for skilled nursing facilities, but we can clarify that later on.
Yeah, we will.
Okay.
Nah.
Thank you, Dr. Sackler. Our next question comes from Susan Arnott. Ms. Arnott, your line is open.
Hi. My question also has to do with nursing homes. When our patients come in, the Pneumovax and flu vaccine status is documented on the nursing home literature. Now, does that need to be transferred to our paperwork? I've been told in the past that it does, but something someone said made me think I'm wrong.
Let me understand your question. You're asking when a nursing home patient comes into the hospital and the documentation is on the nursing home paperwork.
Correct.
Does that documentation have to be transferred to the hospital's paperwork?
Correct.
No.
It would be evidence. You have to record on your admission assessment that it was previously given within the time frame, either handwritten or on our form. There's a checkbox that just says previously immunized this flu season or previously received at least one time after age 65, and the nurse could just check that. So in essence, the data would be on our form, so we do have a copy of the skilled nursing facility information in the chart, so it's there.
What we'd like to do is, if that data is on the nursing home paperwork,
then the little box that says previously administered, we would put the date there.
Yes, I understand that, but what I'm asking is there a problem if it, in other words, can we abstract it as given if it only appears in the nursing home paperwork?
I think that we can, as long as it's a part of that hospital stay, which we include that documentation as part of the patient's record.
Yeah, and so this is Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. Yes, I would, if you have that evidenced in that material from the nursing home, I would include that in the chart as well, if you can. Do that.
So I can abstract that as given, as yes.
Yes, and that documentation needs to be evident in the chart, though, if you can copy.
Right, if everything goes right into what charts.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arnott. Our next question comes from Renee Cutway. Ms. Cutway, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. Going back to question number 10, we have a pre-printed order set titled Decompensated Respiratory Admission Order, COPD/asthma/pneumonia. If the physician writes on the diagnosis line, rule out sepsis, would this be considered a rule in for pneumonia because our title has the word pneumonia on the preprinted order set?
Are you using the order set for a multitude of potential diagnoses?
Correct.
Correct.
Hi, this is Dr. Stimler. I would think it's likely that it will be counted because it's very close to the other one, and as long as pneumonia is mentioned as one of the options on the order set. Karen, what do you think?
I am agreeing with you. Can you just repeat the title of that document again?
Sure. The title is Decompensated Respiratory Admission Order, and then in parentheses it has COPD/asthma/pneumonia.
Yeah, I would use that. I will also check for you for clarification.
Okay.
I think that would be okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cutway. Our next question comes from Kara Lizes. Ms. Lizes, your line is open.
Yes, hello. We have a few questions, actually. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The first is for the people from Benedictine Hospital. Do you have any type of a database flag so that when patients come in with subsequent admissions, you can quickly see that they had received the pneumococcal vaccine and that you've already extracted that data at some point?
It's not flagged, but it can be put in a piece of the database that does come with a patient every admission. It's called clinical circumstances in our system. And if all things work well, it would be there. But generally, unless it's clearly positive there, we would go through the whole process for every admission.
There is a way with the ICD coding for pneumococcal and influenza vaccines. So if we needed to do by the month a database, we could pull that up through medical records. However, it wouldn't have the individual names. I think it would just end up with a number set.
I understand, I think, where you're going with much more robust clinical information systems there. Mm-hmm. There's a whole series of flags you can get on each admission, which is very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would make it easier, certainly. My second question regards notifying the primary care physician when the patient received the vaccine in the hospital. How do you go about doing that?
Well, on our form, where the nurse would sign off at the bottom of the screening tool that the vaccine was actually given, part of our protocol is for the either the nurse or the unit clerk to fax it to the physician's office so he has a hard copy available.
It's documented on that form that when it was faxed to the physician's office.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to someone else here who has a couple other questions.
Okay, my question is regarding your admission or screening nurse. Is that one person per unit or one person per hospital, and does that person actually screen every admission, or is each RN responsible to screen their own patients?
It's only one full-time equivalent, unfortunately. We would like to have more of her. So she only gets through a critical mass during that one. She does a modified shift where she starts a little later on days to mirror the time of admission. But obviously she can only get to 6 or 7 admissions during her shift. So, yes, it's the responsibility of all nurses to know what to do and how to do it. But at least part of it was her using her as an example. The nurses got more and more used to seeing the paperwork all completed in a nice, tidy package or getting a report from her saying, the patient submitted, I've ordered the vaccine, and please give it when it comes up.
Does she have other duties besides actually screening patients admitted, and is it all admissions or just your pneumonia admissions that she...
No, she's a generalist. She does all, mostly all medical, general medical admissions into oncology, telemetry, or general medicine. That's where she primarily focuses. And, you know, it just depends on how the admissions come in. But she does everything, the complete admission assessment database, starts the initial plan of care, settles the patient, does their vital signs, and starts the screening process for the vaccination.
If you have a patient you are unable to assess, the patient either can't answer or is unsure, and after trying to call and extract the data from the physician's office, if you still can't, do you give it anyway? And if so, have you had any adverse reactions to the patient receiving more than one immunization in a short period of time?
We would give it, and we haven't had any adverse events.
And my last question goes back to the data that's actually extracted. Am I right in assuming that only those patients who have a final discharge diagnosis, including pneumonia, are the patients that are counted into our database and where the data is extracted? Did I understand that, or is it also patients that have it as an admission diagnosis?
It's final diagnosis.
Okay, so it's on the discharge summary, well, wherever you may keep it, but that is the diagnosis that you're using to extract the data from.
Yes, correct? It never falls into the ICD population for pneumonia.
Okay, one last thing. If an X-ray is taken at another facility and the patient comes to the emergency room, does the X-ray have to be repeated at the hospital, or is that okay as long as they've had one somewhere?
Not to my knowledge. We don't have enough information of the July issues that are coming up with the positive chest X-ray required.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dante, I think we'll take one more call.
Okay. Our next question and final question is from Ms. Linda Henning. Ms. Henning, your line is open.
Hi, I'm calling from St. Luke's Cornwall in Newburgh, and my name is Linda Hennigan. My question is clarification, please, regarding a patient that comes in with wound care. Is it only professional wound care and stated as such, or often we see patients come into the ER where the nurse will say that they have a stage 2 decubitine, they put a Tegraderm on it or something like that. It seems that those patients are at risk, but is it only, like you say, professional wound care, and does it include IV sites or Brobiac sites or colostomies? Can you clarify that? Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
We very rarely get documentation from a patient that says they have visiting nurse services doing wound care.
Correct.
They have seen it once.
For the extent of the wound care, I do not have any information for the level that you're speaking about, but I can check that out. They've just made a generalization, home wound care, and I'll have to get back to you.
Okay. Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Can you clarify Pseudomonas risk? Is it has to be documented that the patient has COPD with repeated antibiotic use and or steroid use? They have to have both of those wordings stated by a doctor, a nurse practitioner, or PA. That's another thing we don't see very often.
I think we'll have to, we'll have to clarify that as far as what the specs read.
Right. I believe this is Dr. Stimler. I believe the specs on that have changed, but at least the ones that I've gotten a hold of right now do say that simply the statement by a physician, nurse practitioner, or PA that there is a pseudomonal risk is should be acceptable.
We rarely see that in a hospital, maybe in a bigger hospital, but...
One of the things I generally recommend is, the spec manual does change, as you know, and it sometimes makes it kind of difficult to know in any given period of time what are the inclusions and exclusions, because there's sort of a migration always of these. But once you see something like an acceptable feature being that it's a physician documented or a nurse documented, it's very often worth doing the education internally to the institution, because if a physician documented pseudomonal risk is taken, then if your physicians are documenting it that way, you don't have to worry about anything else. Regardless of how the rest of the specification manuals change from quarter to quarter, from year to year, you could kind of put all of that out of your mind and not have to deal with any of the, painful, detailed questions about where in these gray zones, where you draw the line. So, just as a general good thing to do. My advice would be, where you see this as being a possibility, consider the value of provider education in these contexts, because I think it saves a lot of, it makes it a lot clearer on the chart for the abstractors. It makes it a lot clearer for you when you're doing your, when you're worried about validation issues. That would just be my general advice.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henning.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to do a little last-minute housekeeping issues here. Just as a reminder, the answer to your questions will be posted on Jenny. The questions just recently posed at the end of the conference call here, we will clarify the answers to those, and we will also include those as part of the posting for verification of what the answers are. The other thing is that... if you do have additional questions that were not able to be answered, there's a comment section on the bottom of the evaluation form, and you can certainly address your question there to us, and we can get those questions answered for you, too, at that time. I would like to take the opportunity to just remind you once more to complete the meeting evaluation, and the instructions to get that to us, either fax or email, or regular mail, are on the bottom of the form. I would certainly like to thank Karen O'Leary and Dr. Stimler for their participation in the call, as well as all of our participants from Benedictine Hospital. I certainly think that this is a valuable exercise in sharing and learning from each other about how best to implement some of these measures. At this point in time, this concludes our conference call, and I would like to thank you for your participation.